about to get started to answer the question of the hour, which is whether American Grand Strategy has gone missing. My name is Sylvie Stainton, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Aspen Institute Society of Fellows, and it's my privilege tonight, or this afternoon, to introduce Rana Faruhar with the Financial Times. I almost said it wrong, but I'm glad I didn't. But Rana is going to introduce this, the rest of the panel, and hopefully we'll find out at the end of it whether we do have a grand strategy in place or not. Thank you so much.
Great, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here to do this panel. It's such an opportune moment for it. I'll just quickly introduce our panelists, and then we're going to have about 30, 35 minutes of discussion, and then we're going to open it up to questions for all of you, and then come back for some final statements. So I'm Rana Faruhar. I'm an editor at the FT and a columnist, as well as an analyst at CNN. To my left is Richard Haass, who is the head of the Council on Foreign Relations. To his left is Wendy Sherman, who is the senior counselor at Albright-Stonebridge and former Undersecretary of State. To her left is Samantha Power, who is now at Harvard and was formerly the U.S. representative to the UN. And then at the end, we have former Congresswoman Jane Harman, who's now head of the Woodrow Wilson Center. So great perspective, great group to talk with this issue.
Four women and one man, so.
Yeah. Hello. Diversity. Cognitive diversity.
First time I've ever been diversity.
And Richard has stubble, which is also diverse. So. All right, I'm going to start with the obvious question. Diverse for him. Don't forget, we already did an hour together. We've been through this. So I'm going to start with the obvious question, I guess, and kind of just go down the line and ask you to give a minute or two of, do you think the U.S. still does have a grand strategy? Richard, you go.
The short answer is we have elements of one, but it's a very different one. For a long time, we did have a grand strategy of essentially being the principal upholder of a global order, and it meant supporting alliances in Europe and Asia, promoting free trade, other international institutions when on balance we thought they were in our interest, discouraging the use of force to change borders and so forth. Many of those precepts are now no longer embraced, and I think increasingly our strategy is less one of preservation than it is one of disruption. And so it's not consistently so. There are some things that I think have been positive, the use of limited force after chemicals in Syria, highlighting the importance that North Korea not be able to develop ballistic missiles that can reach us. But all things being equal, the strategy might be a little bit too grand of a word, but the bias, the leaning, the DNA of the administration is one towards, the strategy is much more one towards the disruption, and the tactic that is associated with it is much more one of unpredictability.
Okay, Wendy.
So I would associate myself with most of what Richard said. I would add a few things. One, I think that the concern that I have is that that disruption does not become destruction of not just the world order that was created after World War II, but more importantly, the United States' sort of projection of our power around the world. In the past, we have believed in a global community. We have believed that we need to pursue both interests and values simultaneously. We have believed that we are a very powerful nation, but we do not live in the world alone, and so we would work and play with well with others, what we try to teach our children, and that we, in fact, try to solve problems as opposed to create them. Now, we're in a place where there is enormous uncertainty among populations all across the world, and you'll hear some of that tomorrow from the Pew Global Attitudes Project. But people are anxious that globalization has brought a lot of good things that they like, but they're very concerned about their identity, their way of life, which leads one to want strong leaders who are going to sort of give you an orthodoxy that will somehow organize your life. And so I think we have, and other countries around the world, are more and more willing to give up ourselves to that strength in return for certainty, when in fact that certainty has turned out to be disruption, not creation.
Okay, great. Samantha.
Well, I think the concept of grand strategy would have to be, in any event, even if we weren't in the moment we're living, extremely elastic to capture what any one country has to do. And I think Richard has given the sort of top line of a liberal international order undergirded by the United States. That order is in our interest. We wrote the rules. When I was ambassador to the UN, benefited from those rules. Most countries resent the fact that we wrote the rules benefit us, but we are walking away from that system, as has been said. But the elasticity is one because it, you know, unlike during the Cold War, you have to accommodate a foreign policy that can deal simultaneously with climate change, with cyber threats, with terrorism, which itself vests in places with such weak governance, parts of the world that we never thought were on our mattering map. I mean, you might provide some charity support and wish them well, but now if we have an embassy there, those terrorists are setting up bases, our diplomats are at risk, our aid workers are at risk. We need a grand strategy, or a strategy, forget grand, that accommodates the Shia-Sunni split, but also within Sunni Islam, Islamism, and the more extremists, or what can border on extremism, to the more secular approach. I mean, so we need a foreign policy that can accommodate all of that, but at its heart is, as has been said, U.S. leadership. And I think what's defining the current moment of U.S. leadership is excessive a la carte-ism. So a conception that you can fight ISIL, make ISIL your priority, you know, Islamic terrorism, or however you want to define it, and then have a Muslim ban, and that Muslim ban, or however it gets, plays out, you know, through the courts, that will have no bearing on your ability to fight terrorism. Or you can talk about human rights in Cuba, like, with great passion and feeling, when you've already, as Wendy said, renounced human rights as a fundamental aspect of your foreign policy. So the thing that you learn just in the real world, and these guys will learn, and our military is already well aware of this, is when we go to European countries and say, keep your troops in Afghanistan, we've decided we're going to give it another go and really, you know, take another run at the Taliban or now at ISIL, the fact that we've just walked away from the Paris Agreement has bearing on whether European publics support their leaders agreeing with us to do something in the national, in the
No dot connecting.
Just a sense. We do what we want when we want it, and we're very transactional, but we don't see that you got to put money in the bank so that you can draw on your ATM.
Okay. Jane, do you want to jump in?
Well, this panel may be four women and one man, but we're all card-carrying members of the swamp. So I thought I'd put that out there. And so are some of the people advising the current administration, card-carrying members of the swamp. And I'm okay with the swamp because I think experience and understanding linkage matters, especially in foreign policy, and I know everyone agrees with me. Would you believe that Mike Pence came to the Wilson Center last week and I interviewed him about a conference he went to the week before in Miami with Rex Tillerson and John Kelly to discuss Central America and their hopes, certainly all of our hopes, that those governments can become stronger. It is true that, I'm sure Wendy will point it out, that the budget is being slashed, the U.S. budget for those places, but there is a strategy to help them recover. But the reason I'm telling you this is Pence said that America first does not mean America alone. And Madeleine Albright always says that America is the indispensable power, but that doesn't mean that America is not also the indispensable partner. So I just put it out there, and I would like to believe, I'm ever the optimist, I'm the only person here who ran for elected office ever, I think. So I did get elected for 9 terms to Congress, and I said, how could I have done that if I weren't an optimist? So I'm an optimist. America first means not, you know, America does not mean America alone. So let's look at this. I think the liberal international order is kind of beat up, but it's still there. And I don't think it's gone missing. I think it's just gone challenged. So let me put out there 5 ways in which it's challenged beyond what I think anybody else said yet. One is technology. I mean, that is a variation on globalization, which is a good thing and a bad thing. A second is terrorism, which is a bad thing. A third is the astounding number of displaced persons in the world. And they're not all displaced by civil wars and unrest. Some of them are environmental refugees, a lot of them, maybe half of them. I think that's right. Fourth, related to that, is climate change. And of course, I'm on the same side as everyone else about the decision on the Paris Agreement. And the fifth, and I know this up close and personal, is toxic partisanship, which has made it almost impossible to do anything. So my bottom line here is we have a tattered, sort of banged up global liberal order, but it's still there. And we have a vice president of the United States who, at least as I heard him, has some interest in maintaining that order, and at least some hope that partnerships and America Connected matter.
Okay, before I ask the next question, I actually want to take a little poll. How many people in this room think that the U.S. does have a coherent national strategy? Raise your hands if you think that. Maybe I should rephrase the question more broadly. Wow. Okay, we're in Aspen.
But in fairness, probably had we been here 3 years ago, so they would have struggled with the same thing.
Well, that brings me to I wanted to take the temperature of the room, but it brings me to why are we here? And Wendy, I might ask you and Richard and others jump in if you want to add to this. I mean, is the Trump administration about on a whole nother panel. Is it a symptom of something deeper that has been in the works for a long time? And what is that something?
So when I talk about this, I say that back in 2002 when Pew did its first survey, and I was a consultant to them at the time, and for full disclosure, my husband Bruce Stokes helps do the polling. He's running around Europe doing the briefing Mike Dimmick's going to do tomorrow. People liked globalization and technology. They liked what it brought them, better drug choices, better food choices, blue jeans, American entertainment. They still love American entertainment. But they were terrified of losing their way of life and their sense of identity. And I believe that has come home to the developed world. I think people feel very unmoored, and I think what President Trump touched, and touched profoundly, was the 55-year-old guy in middle of America who lost his manufacturing job because there are always winners and losers in trade. There's always winners and losers in technology. And we don't have a safety net in our country for those folks, not one that's effective in any way. And that guy was told to take a coding course, and after 2 years, he'd make half of what he had made before. He still has to put two kids through college. His wife works part-time. And they can't afford it because college loans are too high. And at the same time, although I'm thrilled that people can marry whom they love, the social change has come very fast. Women in the workplace, full-time, life has changed. Their kids work on their iPhones for everything in their lives. Digital technology has changed how people communicate with each other. And so this family, these parents feel unmoored, unanchored. And they are looking for strength and certainty and a way forward, and they don't feel anybody's had their back. And so what many in the developing and emerging markets have felt for quite some time, except they have optimism because they still have a ways to go, particularly in Africa, there's great optimism. In the developed world where our economies, post-industrial, have reached sort of a slower point and a slower development, there's tremendous anxiety.
Let me pick up on something you said and ask others to chime in. I mean, absolutely all these things are true. And there's been, one of the reasons we saw populism, frankly, on both sides of the aisle in the U.S. and abroad is that there is a lack of trust or a disbelief now in institutions and the people that have run them, in the rules that were developed by the U.S., maybe not so successfully communicated that there were going to be winners and losers in that. Is the lack of a coherent U.S. agenda right now in part about the challenges to neoliberalism and the institutions that flowed out of it and the kind of U.S. vision around this for the last few years? Richard, do you want to give that a go?
Yeah, the violent agreement on the panel may end here.
Yeah, we like that.
Look, I think Wendy's right. The president tapped into it. The problem is his prescriptions, I think, were dead wrong. To scapegoat trade, to scapegoat immigration was not at all productive. Both have, I think, been great drivers of economic success in this country. I don't think the problem is inequality. I think the problem is upward mobility or the lack of it. And I worry about a focus on inequality because that ends up with certain politics of redistribution and the like, which I believe will never be broadly supportive. I think the real problem in America right now is that upward mobility is a phrase, but in many cases it's no longer a reality. And I think it's only going to get worse with the press of technology.
Absolutely.
We agree. And it's not just going to be, by the way, the 50-year-old guy has a high school education. Mm. It's going to be increasingly white-collar jobs. A wide variety of jobs. McKinsey's done very useful work on this. A wide variety of jobs is going to be vulnerable. Mm. And so coming up with a social response to that, and I think it will be an amalgam of education, training, portability of various safety nets. I think corporate tax reform would really help to repatriate all sorts of money for investment here. I think infrastructure programs. I think we have a major debate about safety nets and whether they ought to be unconditional or conditional and so forth. But I think that's where we are as a society, mm-hmm. and we better get there fast. Because the pace of technological innovation, I think it was President Obama's last speech in Chicago, and he used the word relentless, mm-hmm. and that was exactly the right word. It is the relentless pace of technological innovation, and either in this country, many others, the social, economic, political response is not only are we not catching up, in some ways we're falling farther behind, and I think that is the big cloud. Just 30 more seconds, like Macron won in France, which is great, I thought, but it's not a permanent answer, it's a respite. Mm. And I think he and others have a couple of years, or we're gonna see the return of our populism with a vengeance there and elsewhere.
Go ahead, jump in.
Well, to take it in a slightly different direction, all of us have said some version of this before, so it's a little repetitive, but we do have to be a little careful about overlearning from the election, right? Or even from the populism that has reared its head in a number of different places, insofar as, but for a few elements, all of us can name them, maybe a former FBI director and some of his moves, what Russia did in the election, some campaign choices perhaps that the Clinton campaign made, independent candidates in the race. We'd be up here talking about Jane's point about the flaws in the liberal international order, the flaws in the international system, and we'd be taking for granted she was against TPP too, but maybe some revised version of an international trade pact. My point is that history is very contingent, and we've, from my standpoint, landed contingently in a very dangerous and worrying place that could heighten the collapse of the liberal international order and not only heighten the factors that gave rise to Trump in the first place. The point I wanted to raise in the different direction was I think we, and I'll even say in the Obama administration, struggled to talk to people in a way that made them feel that we heard their fears. So I think...
Why do you think that was?
I think A, it's just hard. B, when we did it well at times. Not maybe, I think, again, there's lots we can look back on and wish we'd done differently, but Fox News isn't playing it when we do it well, right? They're taking some soundbite and using an ellipses and distorting even what we've said. I mean, the prior version of fake news didn't help us. But to give a couple examples, on Ebola, I think in the first instance, it was never said, but it almost could have been said by one of us, more Americans have married Kardashians than have died of Ebola in the United States. We didn't say it, but some... That was sort of the a little bit, as we led and led the world, and I think it's, again, one of an unheralded chapter, and if Ebola happened today in West Africa, God help us all, including in this country, because it would come even as we tried to build a wall and wouldn't have dealt with the problem at its source. But that's one example. I think terrorism, too. I think if you look at the president's language over the course of the last couple of years, it evolved a lot in meeting people where they were. Refugees, where we... Yep. We're late, actually, in leading on Syrian refugees as such, but on mm-hmm. refugees generally, we had good numbers, decent numbers throughout, and they got higher. Just what do you do, right, when you have the data to show, that the fears as they are being felt mm. are not commensurate with the risk, as we've, clinically studied it and so forth. And I think to continue, one of the things that progressives have done, or at least one part of the party is, I think, in retrospect, is tell people there's never been a better time to be born, life expectancy. And, mm-hmm. and because of some of these dynamics that Wendy and Richard and you have touched upon, Jane, I mean, that's not where what people are feeling. So yeah. I don't know how you simultaneously, address the fear in a way that makes people feel heard in a polarized media environment where your best version of the argument isn't necessarily going to get a fair hearing. but also bring true facts to bear, because we couldn't have led on Ebola or refugees had we merely deferred to
Let Jane in. You wanted to make
a comment. Well, first of all, I'm still in violent agreement with Richard. I'm not sure why, but no, I seriously am. And I think a lot of the things that you sketched out are things that both parties agree with. Certainly the missing center of both parties, because neither party has a center anymore, which is, I think, a real tragedy for the country. But I was going to point out that I was elected to Congress in 1992, first elected office I ever sought other than junior high school treasurer, which I lost. And Bill Clinton was too. And the dominant, he belonged to something called the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, which was a part of the Democratic Party that I also belonged to. And I was elected in a lean Republican district, and he was elected in, at a time when most people didn't think he could be. And looking back on that, many people writing about the Clintons think that they forgot what the issues were that they used to, both of them, to become the force that they were and are in the country. And I think we've lost that. And I think that a lot of that, the sort of sensible center, is missing. That's what's missing in both parties. And it matters. The other thing I was going to say, though, is because of technology and the internet, it is much harder for leaders, that would be elected people, to tell followers what to do. It really goes the other way now. People are empowered at the grassroots. It's not top down, it's bottom up.
Yep.
That was the Arab Spring or the Arab Winter that we witnessed 5 years ago. And that bottom up phenomenon is very hard to manage. That's what Samantha's talking about.
Yeah.
And you have to have special language if you're going to be heard by sort of highly passionate, whether they're organized or not, group of people who use the web to get their information and to tell you what to do.
Yeah. Well, Wendy, you had made
it. That's why the president tweets.
Yeah, that's why, and you'd made a very interesting point when we were talking before this panel about how maybe the internet is the institution now, which, you know, you could argue, right?
Right. Well, I say that a little glibly. What I mean by it is that people communicate, as Jane has just said, in incredibly different ways. Most of us in this room aren't intuitive about the technology that our kids and our grandkids are easily intuitive about. Mm. I'm certainly one, I will confess, who when something goes wrong, I scream for the 21-year-old to tell me how to fix it, because I haven't a clue. So I think that, again, what President Trump has understood, and needless to say, I'm no fan of the president's, is that one can communicate directly with people through digital media, through those tweets, for God's sakes. How many speeches do we all recall except his inaugural speech? Virtually none, because that's not his mode of communication. Mm. President Obama's major mode of communication was the traditional one, to give big speeches, some of which were powerful and brilliant. And I hesitate to say, but I think it's critical, looking out at our audience and looking out at most of us, that there is no doubt that we just had 8 years of an African American president is not a factor in all that we are experiencing today. Mm. When we make social change, when we make a decision to do something we have never done before, we then take two steps backwards, at least. I believe in my bones among the list, I agree with the list that Sam put out about why Hillary lost, but I would add to that that it was pretty hard to elect a woman after you've elected the first African-American president.
So let me pull back for a minute, because we have a lot going on here, and this is a big topic, so we're not going to be able to encompass everything in detail, but it sounds like a lot of what we're talking about is the fact that a lot has changed on the domestic scene, economically, politically. There's not agreement amongst various folks in various centers of powers about, you know, kind of what the problem is and how to fix it. I mean, even the reasons behind the populism at the moment, we're still arguing, are they economic, were they social or cultural in some ways? Richard, you know, I'm just struck again by your last book and the point that you made in your current book about how you really can't have a grand strategy and project power on the international stage if you have problems at home that you haven't fixed.
Well, it's two things. You've got all the problems at home, which are distracting. Mm. They absorb resources, and the resources aren't otherwise made available. But I think the bigger problem at home, partially what Jane was saying, the lack of a strong center, but there's a lack of an intellectual consensus. You know, the U.S. foreign policy during the Cold War, you know, for all the debates about Vietnam and everything else, were somewhat bounded by containment. And containment could survive everything except success. And when the Cold War ended 25 or so years ago, it really opened up the foreign policy space, and it didn't divide between parties. Mm. Within each party, you had major differences. So part of what Donald Trump is doing is very similar to what Pat Buchanan was saying a generation ago. You've got people like me who are kind of more established and who are probably closest to Bush 41. You had the neocons who basically saw a transformation. Democrats have their own divisions, you know, however you want to slice and dice the cake. So I think that was underway. And I think what's happening now is there's no agreement about how important foreign policy should be, how much of our resources should it absorb. What are our priorities in the world? Is it to promote democracy, human rights, values? Is it to do other things? Are things like trade useful vehicles for the United States? What about alliances? And so on. So I think there's now and it used to be for much of the last 25, even 70 years, most of the foreign policy debate, to use if I'm allowed a sporting analogy, took place within roughly the 35 or 40 yard lines within both parties. What's so interesting now is on both parties, it's now taking place in the end zones. Mm. This is something very different. So the givens are no longer broadly shared. And things that you're seeing, particularly under this president, and I think the biggest question for all of us, and there's no way of answering it, is whether this is an aberration or a trend. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fundamentally different if this is a 4 or 8 year aberration, and then we, if you will, come back to something like the old debate, which wasn't pure consensus, but it was a bounded debate, or whether now it's a much broader, in a sense, unbounded debate about America's role in the world and how we carry it out. Very different consequences for this country, fundamentally different consequences for the world.
I think that's a great framing, and I'd like to ask the three of you, do you think this time is different, or are we going to, you know, this is an aberration, we go back. Samantha, why don't you?
Well, I think referendum, to Jane's point earlier, referendum approaches to foreign policy would never have worked well for our interests as understood by the people on this panel. I mean, so even in the Cold War and right through the 90s, we all know the polling on foreign aid and what people think it is and how horrified they are and so forth. I mean, the truth is that there's been top-down leadership and a little bit of a, not quite smoke and mirrors, but an elite consensus that probably, if ever pushed or tested, was not likely to be very thickly supported at the grassroots, if I had to guess, probably in the wings of both parties. Mm. I think what's significant and very disturbing now, because again, keep coming back to the polarized media environment, not just because I'm married to Cass Sunstein, who just gave a talk on the polarized media environment a couple hours ago, but it really matters. It plays out on every one of the issues where these this lack of consensus emerged. So take refugees. Mm. So to my earlier point that, you know, it's not as if in the past, we had this halcyon time where we were so welcoming of refugees at a grassroots level. Turns out, the polling has always been terrible. It was terrible for Jews in the Second World War. It was terrible, if you can believe it, for Hungarians fleeing the Soviet crackdown in 1956. It was terrible for the Vietnamese boat people. We've always had a majority of people who didn't want refugees to come. But our governments just in the case of the Second World War, didn't do it, unfortunately, but in the latter cases, eventually got around to doing it. What's different now is the opposition breaks down completely on party lines. So Democrats now are much more, if you look at the polling, much more supportive of allowing refugees in, Syrian refugees specifically, perhaps in part as a reaction to Trump. They're probably more supportive now than they would have been under Obama when we were pushing this. Yeah. And the GOP has lined up, you know, behind, again, these messages. And if you were watching Fox News, I mean, I'd be for that too. I'd be for building all kinds of walls, right? And believing that those would be the way, in fact, to protect your kids. Mm. So I think, again, that referendum policy, the reason it's not different is that it's always been hard to sell these kind of deeper, longer term commitments. You know, if you ask any family, I mean, yes, the Cold War, of course, there was that.
I feel like what you're saying, the subtext of what you're saying is we will not be able to have a grand strategy until, like, Silicon Valley comes up with a different business model because the media
do their part.
I mean, this goes to your point, but
I'll
let you jump in a minute, but Jane, go ahead.
I don't know that we need Silicon Valley to do it, but I often say that the business model of Congress is broken. the business model. Not everybody in Congress. There are good people in Congress in both parties, and there are less good people in Congress in both parties. How's that for me? Very polite. So, but the business model that each party uses, and it was used in this election, is to blame the other side for not solving the problem, demonize the other side in many cases because they don't even know the other side, because Congress only works 2.5 days a week, so they fly in, fly out, sleep in their office, and just know a few people on their committees, which don't function because most of what's voted on the floor of Congress now is leadership driven and not a product of committee deliberation, which used to be kind of helpful. But at any rate, the business model's broken. If it's just the blame game, and if you get punished for working on a bipartisan basis, which is the case, think Dick Lugar, who lost in his primary. Primaries are more important now than general elections because he worked with Democrats. Or think, you know, pick a Democrat in the same boat. But the point I'm making is we need a new business model. Mm. How do we get a new business model? We need leadership someplace. I was hoping that there would be a president committed to making Congress work. I don't see any signs of it, and I don't know, to be fair, whether Hillary would have invested in it. She certainly had the capacity. Obama did not invest in it after trying it out for the first 10 minutes. He didn't invest in it. And so we lost a lot because Congress doesn't work. And just one last thing, at least if we're talking about foreign policy, Congress has a pretty big role, or used to, in foreign policy. Some of the great debates we had were in Congress. Congress, under the Constitution, and everyone swears an oath to uphold the Constitution, has the obligation to declare war. We have a couple of wars going on, like five, and there is no, as far as I'm concerned, relevant authorization to use military force that applies to any of those wars. And Congress now, several members have introduced a new version. Jeff Flake and Tim Kaine have one that I think is interesting. But at any rate, the chances of that happening are pretty much zilch.
Okay, you've been shaking your head, and then we'll go, let Richard jump in, and then...
No, I actually think that what Jane said applies much more to domestic policy. I think in foreign policy, in national security, the political tradition of America is that the president, the executive branch, enjoys tremendous latitude, tremendous discretion. Up to this president, I thought that was a good thing by and large, because it led American internationalism. The president, virtually all of his big things, whether it's pulling out of TPP, pulling out of Paris, raising questions about alliances, using military force as he did in Syria, increasing the troop numbers in Afghanistan, he's done all of these things without recourse to Congress. So I don't think there's any fix. To me, that's almost irrelevant. You can argue whether this is the right way we should be making national security policy, but it is the way, it has been the way. So I think a lot of this simply has to do with this president's exercise of executive discretion as he sees fit. Most of his predecessors also exercised tremendous discretion. He just basically is taking American foreign policy in a very different direction. So there's no way to fix the business model. This is a very different understanding of what America should be doing in the world. And he represents a departure. If you like it, it's a welcome departure. If you disagree with it, it's obviously something very different.
Wendy, I would say, and it builds on Richard's comment, there are two trends that are of enormous concern to me. One is a corporate trend in foreign policy. I think a lot of these decisions have been made on the basis of what is good for business and for the economy without regard to a longer term strategy of what that will mean for national security, which ultimately undergirds economic security. So I think it's short-termism. We saw in the op-ed that McMaster wrote that he believes there is no longer a global community. There are just competing interests and competing agendas, which is very much a business model, very much a corporate model. I'm out there, I'm going to get my bottom line, and I'm going to make sure you're not going to get your bottom line. We're seeing that at the State Department in what's happening. I think Secretary Tillerson, when he was CEO, if he turned to people in his company and said, we've got to tighten our belts, people had to tighten their belts.
Yeah.
The President of the United States has said, you need to cut the State Department, so he's going to cut the State Department. He believes that's what his job is, to create greater efficiency. So I think we're seeing a corporate model. The second trend that concerns me is a militarism that concerns me greatly. I have tremendous regard for Secretary Mattis. I continue to have tremendous regard for him. I think military leadership is tremendously important, and I certainly couldn't have done any things I did
in government without strong support and the use of credible force in service of diplomacy, which is a critical element to anything you do in diplomacy. On the other hand, although I believe that other administrations, including the Obama administration, micromanage some of the military and tactical decisions, I believe way too much has now been sent down to a military level to make decisions about our troop levels, about what they do. And the concern of that is the president is not owning the fact that Richard has just talked about, which is he is the commander in chief. That is fundamental to being president of the United States, and he's given it away.
Yeah. You've hit on something I think very important, particularly in your first point. How do you, in an age where economic globalization has gone way ahead of political globalization, I mean, countries are still run as countries, and yet you have interests that are totally global. How do you even articulate a national strategy? How do you plan it? Only got about 20 minutes left. Let me open it up now for questions, and we'll take some questions from the audience, and then we'll come back at the end and let people have a few final words. Question over here, and we've got some mic runners, so we get a mic up here.
Maybe not.
Gentleman in the blue.
Having a technology problem.
Exactly.
This is a question for Richard. Richard, so if you were advising President Trump, and you only get one area that you can redirect his national security policy, what would it be and why?
Well, I've already had the opportunity to advise President Trump, which is why I'm sitting here in Aspen. One area. I'll give you maybe one would be process, because so much is related to how you make the policy. You can only, you need a formal national security policy process, and it's got to be the only one. We can't afford more than one at a time. We need to have one. There can't be informal individuals or processes. To me, I thought was one of the most worrisome moments was the moment when the president was delivering a speech in Europe. You had a speech draft, and substantively, he took out the reaffirmation of our commitment to NATO. The process, which to me at least is worrisome, that the Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor had signed off on it, and then somewhere between the cup and the lip, shall we say, the text got changed.
That's right.
I was lucky enough. I think I worked for the greatest National Security Advisor in the history of the public, Brent Scowcroft. And in some ways, it was an administration that worked extraordinarily well for lots of reasons. What was so funny is you had more experience per square inch, per pound in that administration, and it was probably the most organized NSC process we ever had. All I will say, without getting into individuals, we probably have less experience with either governing or foreign policy in this administration than in any post-World War II administration, and we have the loosest national security making process. That is probably not a good combination.
Good answer. Another question? Yep. Question over there, way in the back.
How's it going? I have been working and living abroad for the past 5 years and have no doubt of the importance of American leadership in the world and the role that we play. And one of the things when I'm back home I think is so interesting is the compare and contrast between ourselves and China and their, you know, what would many would argue is an extremely grand strategy of 5, 10, 20-year planning cycles. And you all have touched upon bottoms-up planning where it's been, you know, social media-driven and short-termism where, you know, our decision-making process is really framed in 2-year cycles. Could you expand, any of you, on your thoughts on how we could address or mitigate some of those challenges?
Samantha, go ahead.
I don't have a remedy for China, not yet. But I couldn't agree more with sort of the premise of your question. There's a great new book that I recommend to everybody called Thucydides Trap.
Graham Allison.
By Graham. Just the metrics alone surrounding China's rise. I mean, I've read about China for a long time, been deeply interested in it, but there's something about the way that the facts are gathered in this book that is just sort of mind-blowing. And I'll just give you one example that to me just sums it all up, and then I'll get to your question, which is between 2011 and 2013, China both used and produced more cement than the United States used or produced in the entire 20th century. Exactly. But every page of this book, you're going to be like,
true.
No. Oh,
but wait, but wait, is that the mark of good investment or a housing bubble?
It's the mark of a country with explosive growth, where we talk about stagnation, which is real, but with a growth rate that it would blow other countries away. And anyway, but the point is, I saw it at the UN. I saw shifts just in the 4 years I was there in terms of their assertiveness within the UN system. I do think that the accounts of China's rise we know our dysfunction so much better than anybody else's. We're living it every day on every domestic and foreign front. I mean, their issues with pollution and urbanization and, you know, the repression of even basic social activism in order to make the community better. I mean, not, you know, traditional dissidents, but trying to make food safe and energy clean. I mean, that is... it is not the case that this gradient is going to continue as it is. But at the UN, the level of assertiveness, I mean, the difference between 2016 and 2014, I cannot tell you. And they are right now just relishing the retreat on assistance to the United Nations, the retreat on Paris, both for financial, economic reasons and for issues of global primacy. But again, I don't think you can necessarily expect it to go like this. But the way they're throwing their muscle around at the UN, to give just one very brief example, it used to be that they would sit with the developing countries in budget discussions. But now, because they're such a large economy, their share of the budget in peacekeeping, which is a $9 billion budget, is the second largest behind us. For the very first time last year, they moved their chair in the negotiating room, not to our side with the Europeans, the richer countries, but in between the developing countries and us and the Europeans. And it was literally physical. They're like, wait, we know we're not with them because we actually now care about budget cutting, but we're certainly not with you. But you know what they use their leverage to try to secure? The cutting of human rights posts across the UN system.
Wow.
So that is the leadership you're going to see. As we pull back, this is sweet. They're going to step up and other countries, you're going to see the Europeans hanging back and form shopping and not having the spines that we would wish
them to
have.
Jane, do you want to make a quick comment? And then
we'll quick. But for those who haven't read the book, the Thucydides trap is that Athens was the smaller power, but the emerging power, like China, and Sparta was the established power, and they went to war, and both of them ended up losing. But Graham has studied over history all these emerging powers against established powers, and most of the time it ends up in war. His book, hopefully, I haven't got that far, has a chapter about how to avoid the war.
12 out of 16 end in war.
12 out of 16. But what I was going to say is they have a different structure in their government. I mean, they may have a legislature, but the legislature does what the leader wants, and the leader has enormous power. We do have and have had a separation of powers that has helped our country develop and keep our democracy over 230 plus years. And so it's different. And Congress is not playing the role it should. The courts are playing a big role. Our presidents, the last three, starting with Bush, 43, and then Obama, and now Trump, are using commander-in-chief authorities and executive authorities in a greater amount than historically has been used. Part of the excuse is Congress doesn't work. But I just keep thinking that maybe Congress could work.
30 seconds, Wendy, you go.
One point you made that's important for all of us, why I urge that every college student have to go live abroad, is that people start from different places than we do, and we have to understand that. In most places in Asia, it's my experience, people think in terms of dynasties, of long timelines. You're quite correct. We think in 2-year, 4-year, and 6-year increments, Senate, President, House. And if we don't understand people's patience, when sometimes we have none, we're not very effective. Mm. So understanding other people's cultures, time frames, and contexts is absolutely critical.
That's right. Great
and
point.
History.
Another question here.
Hi, I just want to thank you all of the panelists, for such a smart discussion in a time when things are good and bad or incredible or terrible. It's nice to hear a little bit of nuance. I want to ask about why our partners in the world should trust us anymore. We have, our world
balance is based on, and stability is based on, trust in the American system, the United States, let me clarify, as being, you know, largely trustworthy, generally being a good partner in the world, maybe more for the developed than the developing world. So, you know, we're pulling out of treaties, we're changing rules as we go along to benefit us. So, I mean, how long-standing is the damage that we're creating? And I'm not only talking about this administration. It's happened, but there's been some consecutive things, but this may be more than others. So why should we be trusted to be a leader in the world?
Well, the answer is we shouldn't be as trusted as much. And if I were the national security advisor for another country, to use a financial metaphor, I would diversify or recalibrate my portfolio. And I think we're in the process of seeing that. And what we're seeing in particular, our friends who have made the historic choice to put most of their security eggs in our basket, what you will see is greater independent action. And what I'm worrying is over time, you'll see less deference to American interests. I think America First in that sense is a terrible articulation, because it shouldn't be that we're first, we're on equal footing. Alliances are about equality of footing, not preference or precedential. So I think it sends the message that others need to look out for themselves first. I think over time, we will encourage proliferation. I think it was already being encouraged because of what happened in Iraq, in Ukraine, in Libya. But I think this dynamic of how America has now become less certain, less predictable, less reliable, other countries are essentially going to look after themselves more. A world that's more of a self-help society is a more dangerous world. And I think we are moving in that direction. The American alliance system and our involvement in international institutions has been an extraordinary foundation for world order. And almost like healthcare, I feel that we're repealing it, but we're not replacing it.
Does anybody else want to jump in on this?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. All right. A couple more questions over here.
I'm not exactly sure how to frame it. But China has been in Africa building roads, schools, soccer fields, aid. They have the mineral rights in Asia. They've learned from us, our education system. They're expanding in research, which we heard about this morning, in genetics. And it sounds like there's a cultural revolution going on in this country that we're not labeling as such, which is anti-intellectual, anti-education, anti-science. And that threw China back for many years. Mm-hmm. And it sort of started with liberalism, when liberalism became a bad word. So is there any way to sort of let Mr. President Trump know that if he wants to win, he's really got to see this as a revolution against all the values we've had and what that could bring, which we've learned from China's history?
That's a very multi-tiered question. Well, do you want to give that?
Just start to say, you know, I think the policy in the Obama administration, which I certainly subscribe to, is that we should not be afraid of a rising China if a rising China plays by international rules and norms. The trick is, are we still living by those international rules and norms, which I think is your point. And I think that probably the president's going to have to get some hard knocks to understand that. I mean, we all saw President Xi go to Davos and give the speech that an American president could give. But I also don't want to overemphasize the success of China either. Mm. China did a lot of development in Africa, but on their terms, which meant a lot of money would come in loans. Indigenous workers were not given the technical assistance, nor was there capacity building for skills. Rather, China brought in Chinese workers to do the work. Right. And there's been a pretty big backlash in Africa to that, as China has called in loans. There's a lot of loans outstanding from China for countries all over the world that put China has their hand on the throats of a lot of countries, which is a very uncomfortable position. So I don't think it's all roses for China either as we go forward in development. And as they gather strength and move their chair from the developing world to the middle world to the emerging world to the developed world, I think that they also are asked to be, as Bob Zoellick, I think, very wisely said during the Bush administration, responsible stakeholders. And it will be a challenge to us whether, in fact, we stay as responsible stakeholders as well.
Richard, couple
two quick points on China. One is the alternative to a U.S.-led world is not a China-led world. China has doesn't have the inclination, doesn't have the capacity. The alternative of U.S.-led world is probably a nobody-led world, which is not going to be a very orderly world, or possible regionally disorderly like the Middle East.
Yes.
And then the other thing to be said about China, I think it's important, I think Wendy was getting at this, don't think of China as on an inexorable march towards improvement. It's not. I think its dilemmas are different, but at least as large as ours. Mm. I also think the good news is I'm not a fan of the recent literature on the Thucydides trap. I do not think the United States and China are inevitably or inexorably or even likely to end up as adversaries.
The book doesn't say that.
Well,
so
the title and lots of the book argue it's possible and more than possible.
It's totally possible.
And I simply say it is less than likely. That's what statecraft is about, is to make sure it doesn't happen.
Okay.
Well, but just on that point, we've made mistakes before. World War I, as Graham explains, was a colossal mistake, if you look back on it from many vantage points. But at any rate, on this, I thought part of your question was the country's changing. It's now anti-intellectual, anti-education, anti-scientific. I don't think that's true. I think there's a lot of dispute about what the facts are, and that's because of the diversification of media, and people go to their own echo chamber. And it is true that a lot of the news is not accurate, I would say. That's why we need the Wilson Center and the Council on Foreign Relations. Hello. But
thank you, John.
But Richard can't disagree with that one. I think most people want their kids to get an education for a job and a better future. And maybe they disagree about what that is, but I don't think they're rejecting education, and I don't think they're rejecting science. And this isn't the Cultural Revolution in America.
All right. Well, by the way, if anybody else wants to read more about China, I'm going to brag and say I think the FT coverage is amazing, so pick it up. One marketing plug for my paper.
It's like the salmon-colored newspaper.
It's the same as your shirt, actually. all right. We've got about 5 minutes left, and so I want to give the panelists just, you know, kind of a minute each to take on a final question. We've talked about so many of the challenges. We've agreed that there is no coherent national strategy. We've talked about why there is, the fact that we can't even disagree on, or we don't even agree on the roots of populism and sort of how we got to the current political paradigm, corporate interests versus the difficulties of fixing a national agenda, institutional mistrust amongst the population at large, economic challenges at home, media disruption, tech disruption. So, in this landscape, I would like each of you to tell me a lever that you think we can pull to do something that would make it more possible when we come back here in a few years or maybe next year to actually come up with and articulate a coherent strategy. Jane, do you want to start?
Well, ever the optimist, I still think leadership matters. And it's harder to do. The world is more diverse. There is this bottom-up challenge to all leaders. But I think a leader who can sketch a positive vision for where we're going and how the whole country can fit into that and stay on that message and take risks, say, I'd rather do the right thing in this country than be reelected. I don't hear anyone saying that anymore. But I think the person who does that and is positive has a real shot. And I think if that happened someplace, we would have a different conversation in a short period of time.
I actually just to have a small correction of something Richard said. So I agree very much that the executive has had this prerogative on foreign policy, and I agree that's, as one who benefited from that, that's as it ought to be by and large. But when your process point kicks in and you lose checks and balances within the executive, I actually think the self-help society point you made internationally is also beginning to kick in terms of the Congress. So I actually think you saw it in Russian sanctions, almost to a wild extent with 100-0 vote in defiance, really, of what the president's private preferences, we think, would be. You saw it today. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee put a hold on arms sales to the Gulf Cooperation Council because of the rift between Qatar and the Saudis and others. And most importantly, we see it on foreign aid and the budget that wasn't even looked at. Congress just said, okay, I mean, they do have the power of the purse, but we've never seen this kind of just dismissiveness almost. And so what someone asked about trust and why should they trust us, I think you are seeing a tendency at least to dismiss the words of the president or the tweets of the president and ask, you know, Mattis or whomever, what's really your policy or what's going to emerge, you know, over the coming weeks. But so too, you're seeing Congress now realizing that they're going to need to or have decided to assert themselves. And there, I mean, it's very depressing, but I do feel there are some glimmers of hope. I mean, you see Senator Burr and Senator Warner cooperating on the Russia interference investigation, which is very important. On budget, you see Lindsey Graham and Pat Leahy, you know, in lockstep on appropriations around foreign aid as an example. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to see others in our society, the checks and balance kick in the same way as Richard warned. Internationally, you'll see other countries asserting themselves in ways that aren't necessarily good for our interests.
Okay, Wendy.
So I'll give one domestic and one international level. The domestic is everybody in this room and everybody who's here at the Ideas Conference adopted a small city somewhere in this country and went and had a conversation with the Rotary Club or the PTA or the local VFW about national security and foreign policy. Had a real conversation and listened to people's anxieties, fears, and even maybe their misconceptions. Because if we don't do that work at the grassroots, if we just talk with each other, we will only reinforce our own views without understanding why people are where they are and help to change that conversation and refine the center.
Love that.
So that's my domestic suggestion.
Good idea.
My international suggestion, if I were the president, is that I would put as a priority the transatlantic relationship. The strength of that relationship, both economically and in terms of national security, and that old world, the liberal world order, is just extraordinary. We have done remarkable things together, remarkable. And not to invest in it, I think, is very short term. So I would urge all of you who have friends who can talk to the White House, to invest in that relationship, whether it is economically, in terms of national security, because Angela Merkel is going to run Europe with Macron. She will never, ever be the leader of the world because of history. It is baked into the DNA of Germany remembrance, and so she will always stop short of the big leadership some of us might want her to take. It won't happen. The United States, everywhere I went, and in 4 years I went to 54 different countries, many of them several times, everywhere I went, people said, we'll do our part, but America must lead. Everywhere I went. And so if the president doesn't want to lead alone, America first, wants to lead with others, he should start with Europe.
Great point. Richard, last word is yours.
A version of Wendy's. As parents in particular, in some cases on boards of trustees, professors, I would basically start to insist that every graduate of an American high school and every graduate of an American college in that degree was globally literate. Right now, you can graduate from Harvard, Stanford, Yale, and Princeton. If you navigate your course requirements cleverly, you will be globally illiterate. We should not allow anyone to have a degree in this global world who is not prepared to be a good citizen, to be economically able to understand the rest of the world, to basically provide the person power we need in the various arms of the U.S. government. So we need to make, I would argue, global literacy a priority for our educational system.
Terrific. Well, thank you all. Great panel, great discussion. Thanks for listening.